sides of this debate have really good points. You know, sometimes I look at the owners and go, yeah, you make great points here, you're right. Then I look at the players' argument, and they're right as well. And so if both sides stick to their guns, which is their right, and nobody plays baseball this year, everybody loses.
For days now, the negotiations between Major League Baseball's owners and players have been at an impasse, with each side refusing to budge. But yesterday, a sliver of daylight appeared. ESPN's Jeff Passan joins us to discuss whether the latest developments mean baseball could actually come back, or if it's too little too late. Then we discuss the fate of the minor leagues, where a canceled season could prove devastating for teams and players already struggling to get by. I'm Mina Kimes. It's Tuesday, June 2nd. This is ESPN Daily, presented by Marathon. Is this Jeff Passan or is it Jed Passan?
This is Jeff Passan, but Jed Passan may actually have been right, except like a week or so early, maybe?
Jeff Passan is an MLB insider for ESPN. Jed Passan is someone on social media pretending to be Jeff who incorrectly tweeted last week that the league and players had reached an agreement.
Jed Passan actually DM'd me to apologize.
That's actually really nice.
It was. He's like, he or she, don't know.
Yeah, I was saying, yeah, that's not all trolls.
Nope, don't know who Jed Passan is, but Jed Passan said it was intended for my friends. And I didn't realize 10,000 likes later that as many people were going to see it.
So Jeff, talks between the union and the league have heated up as the clock is ticking down. There's been a lot of back and forth with you reporting that the owners are preparing a new offer. But let's back up to last week when they put forward their last offer, which had huge pay cuts for the stars. The players soundly rejected it. Then on Sunday night, MLBPA submitted a counterproposal to the league. What did they ask for?
In that deal was really the opposite of what the owners had proposed earlier in the week. MLB had proposed an 82-game schedule with significant pay cuts that were on a gradient and grew larger for the players who were making more money. This was a total non-starter for the players who have been sticking with this notion of having prorated salaries paid in full. So the players on Sunday came back with not just full prorated salaries, but over 114 games in a season that would run all the way through the end of October so that there would be a postseason in November, which we have never seen before. It was not quite as radical as the owner's proposal was to the players because it included things like potential deferrals and a little tiny give back and saying, hey, we'll have expanded playoffs through 2021 as well. But this was never going to be the type of proposal that the owners would consider, let alone accept.
So what did the owners counteroffer?
Well, the owners haven't countered yet. But what they've done is they've discussed the possibility of going back into this March 26th agreement that they have with the players and utilizing some of the language in there really as a cudgel. This language essentially gives Rob Manfred, the commissioner, the right to make the schedule for the 2020 season. Now, it's after good faith discussion with the players, but it says that a schedule can be made and it has to include economic feasibility. It has to include health and safety. It has to really include all of these different things that could make it viable. In Major League Baseball's mind, the most viable way to pay players a full prorated salary that they desire is to do so over a schedule of about 50 games, give or take a few. And that doesn't seem like a lot because it's not. But it's also the thing that is going to leverage these discussions in one of two ways, Mina. It's either going to get baseball back on the field in 2020, or it's going to get baseball in a courtroom arguing over legalese and over the enforceability of these provisions.
So on one hand, they said, all right, we'll go back to the prorated salaries that you guys have been clamoring for, that you claimed we all agreed to back in March. But on the other hand, we might end up playing significantly fewer games.
Correct. And the reason for that, according to the owners, is that every game that they play this year, they are going to lose money. Now, this is a contention with which the MLB Players Association vehemently disagrees, and it has been seeking out documentation to support this idea, whether it's television contracts, sponsorship agreements, projections internally from clubs on what their revenues would look like, as well as what they would have to pay out both to players, to employees, and to others. They're looking essentially, Mina, for receipts, and the league has yet to provide that sort of information because, well, that sort of information for a long time has been privileged. And I think there are some teams that are afraid that if they give up too much information, it's going to give too much leverage to the players in the future to understand how the finances work exactly. And, you know, if you're a team that's looking to make as much money as you can, you don't want the people who can take the most money from you knowing exactly what your hand is.
Jeff, when the players proposed their deal with 114 games, that meant they would have had to start playing fairly soon, right? Because they would have started June 30th, had to report to camp. I mean, it probably would have had to get a deal done within the week or so. But with this new offer, if there's only 50 or so games on the table, does that mean the clock gets pushed back as well?
Yeah, it could. You know, this is something that we can see potentially starting in like mid-July or so. And you play July, you play August, and then September is your postseason. September, maybe into the early parts of October, or maybe you spread the playoff games around a little. All of the details still need to be worked out. And I still think, Mina, that the implementation of a schedule like this may not be the likeliest outcome here. I almost feel like this is the leverage point that the discussions really needed to get going and to find a place where they can mutually agree on something. And I think because if this were unilaterally imposed by Major League Baseball, that's when the Players Association would be far likelier to file a grievance and to try to litigate this out. And if it gets litigated out, then suddenly the documents that the Players Association are asking for may have to be provided, and those may not be documents that the league wants to provide. And so because of that possibility, I think it would behoove the league as well to look for some sort of mutually agreed upon contract here. But man, we've got a finite amount of time and we've got a lot of groundwork to be done. And while I think that in the end, Mina, baseball will be played in 2020, this is the part where it gets really hairy. This is where the stakes are high and where I think everybody's going to be on edge. And we're going to see if baseball does, in fact, come back right now.
So how much time do they realistically have left to negotiate?
You know, I've been thinking about this for a few days now, because let's remember, they're supposed to be in camp, spring training 2.0, by June 10th. That's the hope. That's the ideal. And it is now June 2nd. There are still players in the Dominican Republic, in South Korea. There are major metropolitan areas that are ablaze on the daily. There are people who need to travel, and maybe not by plane because they're scared and they want to drive. Not to mention, Mina, the fact that the health and safety protocol that was drafted by Major League Baseball calls for like 72 hours of coronavirus testing before players even can report to camp. The idea of June 10th at this point is the moonshot of moonshots. And so I think they're going to push that back right now. And accordingly, if you have 3 weeks of spring training 2.0 to get players healthy, would also have to push back the start of the regular season. So it's tough to see there being games in early July at this point. Odder things have happened, and I understand that a deal could come together really quickly now, but I think that July 4th, you know, America's pastime on America's birthday, is a bit of a long shot at this point.
So what will happen if there's no agreement, if there's no baseball this year?
Mass chaos in terms of baseball's future. What kind of sport are you if you can't claim your season? If you allow yourself to get co-opted by sports like the NBA and the NHL playing out of season, if you allow the time that has gone by where you really could have grabbed a hold of the sporting culture, this great deep desire of fans to watch some kind of live game, and allowed money to get in the way of you being the first major professional American sport to return. The first sport that could capture the attention of the American public and really enrapture it on a nightly basis. I understand we've gotten a little bit more back to normal with bars and restaurants opening up, with cities getting back to where they were. But when we go to those bars and restaurants, what's playing on television? It's not live sports right now. Could be baseball, though. And when we're sitting at home and we feel like we have dried up our entertainment, what's there every single night, Mina? Baseball. Baseball is there for half an hour pregame. Baseball is there for 3 to 3.5 hours of gameplay. Baseball is there for half an hour postgame. You have 4+ hours of your product that you can deliver to a desirous American public for how much time until the NBA or NHL comes back? We have no idea. This is your time, baseball, and are you really willing to screw that up? That's the question that everybody in Major League Baseball and everybody at the Players Association ought to be asking themselves.
After the break, let's talk about the part of baseball that's being hit the hardest by this, the minor leagues. We're presented by Marathon. Now, more than ever, we have to look out for each other and count on each other. And Marathon wants you to know that you can count on them for high-quality, top-tier gas. While we are aware travel might not be top of mind, there might be times where you have to hop in the car to run an errand. Maybe you have to drop off groceries and supplies to your family. Maybe you've become an amazing baker and want to drop off a few dozen cookies on your best friend's porch. Or maybe you just want to drive around to all of your friends' homes simply to wave from a safe distance. But before you head out, remember to fuel up at Marathon. Marathon gasolines are formulated with STP additives. They keep your vehicle running at peak performance by optimizing fuel economy, removing those ugly deposit buildups, and reducing emissions. Remember, wherever you need to go, the people at Marathon are behind you all the way. Marathon, fueling the American spirit. So, Jeff, as we've discussed, if baseball doesn't come back, the impact on the sport and its future will be massive. But baseball will still be around and it'll come back in some form. On the other hand, the minor league system looks like it's never going to be the same after this. Where do things stand at this point?
If we go backward about a year, there were the first discussions of the contraction of the minor leagues. It was put out there and minor league teams were devastated by this idea that they would go from 160 affiliated teams to around 120. The plan that Major League Baseball wanted to hatch was essentially to streamline their operations in the minor leagues. They feel like with the advent of technology these days, it has really helped them assess players at a much younger age and have a sense of who has what it takes to get to the big leagues and to be a successful player. And you compound that with the fact that there are some facilities that are substandard and some organizations want their affiliates to be closer. This was not a full-on gutting of the minor leagues, but it was something that was going to take baseball away from 40 plus communities that it's been, you know, a big part of their city and in some places the lifeblood of their town. Now, after coronavirus, Mina, the entire calculus has changed. it's not just 40 teams that could disappear. It's a lot more, because what we have to recognize about minor league baseball is that this is a sport that subsists on fans being in attendance. There are no television contracts for minor league baseball. There are no big money radio deals. There are no big money sponsorships. Minor league baseball teams exist because fans walk through the gate, buy hot dog, beer, peanuts, cotton candy, and whatever other things they can dream of selling there, have a great time, go home and tell their friends and family about it, and hope that they'll show up a few times a summer too. And without fans in the stands, minor league baseball teams are running the risk of becoming insolvent.
I think it's worth pausing to explain to people what minor league teams actually do for major league teams, right? Because they're not intended to make money for them. Sometimes when people hear this, they say, well, you know, if they're not making money, why should these teams be paying players? But that's not the point, Jeff.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. Some minor league teams, Mina, are making money, and some minor league teams are actually making pretty decent money. But the minor league teams are almost like holding companies where they exist to give a place for these players who are drafted and signed out of Latin America and developed in the minor league organizations a place to play. Now, you could have minor league systems that exist solely in Arizona or in Florida at the complexes that Major League Baseball teams own. But the vast, vast majority of minor league teams are owned independently and not owned by these major league teams, which is why the insolvency issue is such a problem. I talked with one person who's a minor league owner who said he's had to take a second mortgage out on his house and sell his car just to keep the team afloat. And that's what some of these teams are facing.
So while the future of these leagues and teams is up in the air, what we do know is that many of the players have been cut and will not be paid, more so than are normally cut, right, in the spring. Now, Jeff, it seems like the different teams are handling whether to pay the remaining players in a wide variety of ways.
Yeah, you know, you've got a team like the Kansas City Royals, and the Minnesota Twins are another example of this. Both of those teams have said, not only are we not going to cut players when other organizations have cut upward of 50 or 60, we're going to pay them $400 a week through the end of August. And look, $400 a week, Mina, it's not a lot. We all know that. We all recognize that. And the great injustice of baseball is the fact that minor league players get paid the paltry pittance that they do. And that because they have been deemed as, and I use this word laughably, seasonal apprentices. That is a legal definition that is now attached to minor league baseball players due to a bill that was jammed through Congress a couple of years ago. Because they are seasonal apprentices, they can be paid what amounts to be below minimum wage for the amount of time that they put in to their craft, to this thing that they love. And so the $400 a week, while a pittance, is more than some players actually are getting with their normal salaries if they were playing. You have other teams that, Mina, like the Oakland A's, which have altogether stopped the $400 a week stipend for minor league players. They have said to the hundreds of players who are in their organization and who they want to be future major leaguers, who they theoretically value enough to bring up to their big league club, that we want you to continue to stay in major league quality shape, even though we're not going to have a minor league season this year. But we're not going to pay you anything to do so. You just need to do so because you care that much about your future. It is such an abhorrent position to be taken, not to mention the fact that the A's owner, John Fisher, is worth $2 billion. Hopefully, people who listen to this podcast understand that, yes, there is a difference between net worth and liquidity, but that somebody with a multi-billion dollar net worth can probably go and find the $1 million that it would take to make all of his minor league players whole if he wants to. And John Fisher, the A's owner, chose not to.
Right. He's worth, what, $2 billion? So that would be the equivalent of someone worth $100,000 paying $50, if my math is correct.
I trust your math. I'm not able to do it that quickly in my head, but I believe you.
I did it earlier. Well, Jeff, while some owners have decided not to pay their minor leaguers, some players have stepped up. David Price of the Dodgers, who talked about on Monday, Shin-Soo Chu of the Rangers, Sean Doolittle of the Nationals, his team pledged to cover their minor league players within their systems. Then the Nationals, apparently shamed by the backlash, reversed course and announced that they would pay their players. How do you see sort of that conflict, right? Because the players and the owners right now, and the big leaguers I'm referring to, are already at odds. How do you see these players willing to side with the minor leaguers sort of factoring into that overall disagreement?
Mina, I think the players believe that they are on the righteous side here, and that if they are the ones who are going out in the middle of a pandemic to play baseball, then they deserve their full salaries. And that anybody who would not agree with that position to give them their full prorated salaries is not abiding by this compact that you have between players and owners, where owners should treat players right. And owners understand that players are ultimately the game. I think the mistreatment of some minor league players, or at least the lack of empathy toward their situations, really gets in the heads of these players. And they feel like it is their duty and their obligation to stick up for the minor leaguers. But the complicating part of this, Mina, is that for years now, the MLBPA has completely sold out minor leaguers. Like, that's the part of this that that goes unspoken quite a bit. They've sold out minor leaguers in the draft, and you've seen that in a number of ways, and they've sold them out by not allowing them into the union or helping them form any kind of a union. And look, it is called the Major League Baseball Players Association. It's understandable that they're not going to allow minor leaguers in, but the vast, 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 vast majority, almost the entirety of players in the MLBPA right now, once played in the minor league system. And it was only when they got to the major leagues that they recognized the value of the union and understood the power of the union. The problem, of course, is that every dollar that's spent on minor leagues and on minor league players is probably not going to go to where it does right now, which is major league players. Mm. And that has been the inherent conflict there, and really the reason that the MLBPA has not done more for minor leaguers. You wonder, though, if what the individuals are doing right now, and if the organizing efforts of people like Garrett Brosius and others down in the minor leagues will have some sort of an impact, in that within the next 5 or 10 years, we see some kind of labor movement hit the minor leagues.
You know, if we're going to call out the owners, right, for the minor league salaries being but a fraction of their net worth,
yep,
the same thing applies here. It is a fairly small fraction of how much the big leaguers make.
It is. And that's, listen, that's the part of this that's really complicated. Nobody has been a voice for minor leaguers. Nobody has stood up for minor leaguers. And it's why they are where they are and why they've been there as long as they've been.
So I asked you in the first half of this podcast about what would happen if we don't have Major League Baseball. This is a longer term question, but what would happen if minor league baseball goes away or is dramatically reduced?
It worries me less about the quality of baseball that's going to be played, because people are still going to find ways to play baseball games. And I think there's an argument that some player development people, particularly the new school ones, would make that if players are in a controlled environment, we have a much greater ability to mold them to the best of their ability. That being said, losing baseball in small cities across the country is the sort of devastating thing that we've seen in other industries. Minor league baseball is the equivalent of the mom and pop shop. It's a very quaint thing. It's something that evokes these emotional thoughts of summer and sun and freshly cut grass and all of the cliches that involve baseball. It's a romantic business. And how many romantic businesses are left these days? The idea of a romantic business dying because somebody is trying to come in and make it more efficient is just a corporate nightmare come to life. But it's also a reality. And look, if in the end, minor league baseball remains and all of the issues that the league is bringing up, whether it's facilities, whether it's scheduling or otherwise, even pay gets better, maybe the trade-off is worth it, but that's a really, really hard argument to make. And it's going to be a long time, I think, before we get a sense of what getting rid of minor league baseball teams en masse would do for the sport writ large.
Thanks so much, Jeff. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Mina. Appreciate you having me.
Coming up, athletes are protesting across the country, lending their voices to the chorus for change. Hi, guys. Given everything that is happening in the world right now, most of us are buying things online. I saw that AT&T started doing two really helpful things for those who want to buy a new phone or device online. They are offering fast, free, non-contact delivery and curbside pickup, so that online shopping is as simple and safe as possible. On top of that, they have a flexible return policy so you can shop at ease. You can visit att.com to learn how to shop online from the safety of your home 24/7. Subject to change, restrictions apply. Here's another story I want you to know. As protests over the killings of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and Breonna Taylor have spread across the country, a large number of athletes and sports figures have given statements decrying their deaths and racism in general. Some have also showed up in person at these protests, lending their voices to the cause. On Saturday night, Boston Celtics guard Jaylen Brown, who is a vice president of the Players Union, marched in Atlanta while holding a sign that said, "I can't breathe." He was joined by another union VP, Pacers guard Malcolm Brogdon, who had this to say.
"I got brothers, I got sisters, I got friends that are in the streets, that are out here, that haven't made it to this level, that are experiencing it, that are getting pulled over, just discrimination, day after day, dealing with the same bullshit. And this is systematic. This isn't something where we come and, you know, we don't have to burn down our homes. We don't have to. We built this city. This is the most proudly black city in the world. In the world, man. So, like, let's take some pride in that. Let's focus our energy. Let's enjoy this together. This is a moment. We have leverage right now. We have a moment in time. People are going to look back. Our kids are going to look back at this and say, you were a part of that. I got a grandfather that marched next to Dr. King in the 60s. And he was amazing. He would be proud to see us all here. We got to keep pushing forward."
Brown wasn't the only Celtics player to speak out. Marcus Smart and Enes Kanter also showed up at protests in Boston. Knicks guard Dennis Smith Jr. walked in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And in Philadelphia, Sixers players Matisse Thybul and Tobias Harris, who's been a major donor to community causes in the area, joined one of the many peaceful protests taking place. Participation was not limited to the NBA. Saints safety Malcolm Jenkins, formerly of the Eagles, also walked in Philly. And for the South, Broncos safety Justin Simmons led a march in his hometown of Stuart, Florida. In an interview with Nikki Javvala, Simmons cited the famous Martin Luther King Jr. quote, "Riots are the voice of the language of the unheard," and added, "The fact that it took the outrage to get Derek Chauvin in custody, and even then he's only charged with third-degree murder, there's something flawed in the system. Something needs to change." I'm Mina Kimes, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.